Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very excited to have as my guest Ann Beatty. The last time we spoke to Ann, it was a kind of valedictory show about her past stories. We were reminiscing about them. But now Ann has stepped off a balcony into thin air with her new book, which is called Mrs. Nixon, A Novelist Imagines a Life. No one knows yet what to do with this book. Do we give it to biographers, political biographers? Do we give it to nonfiction writers? Is it a novel? Where should it be put in the bookstores? It's the strangest thing I've read in many, many years. Very funny, very moving, very melancholy, and it's a new Ann Beatty. Why Mrs. Nixon, Ann?
I guess if Julia Child was still alive, we could give it to her and she could cook a chicken. I don't know. Maybe that would be the most appropriate response. Why Mrs. Nixon? I asked myself that all the time that I was writing the book. It's almost as though I wrote the book in part to explore something that was an enigma to me. And partly the enigma was the real-life Mrs. Nixon, and partly it was my growing fascination with Mrs. Nixon, remembering her as, you know, the person always at his side or off stage. You know, the also-ran of Richard Nixon became more and more vivid to me as I got older myself.
And this book is a writer's manual as well, in the form of how does a writer take a character about whom nothing is known and work up the material to use for a story. Now, what do we know about Mrs. Nixon?
We know some things about Mrs. Nixon, certainly. I mean, we know biographical facts about Mrs. Nixon. And if we look attentively at the books about Mr. Nixon, it's interesting how little she is there, really, how very little she is there, or the way in which she's footnoted or something like that. But we know that she came from a life of poverty, that she had two brothers, that she lost her mother and father when she was young. We know something about the courtship, although I think there's a lot of hearsay about that. But we do know about Mrs. Nixon primarily from his running for political office and either succeeding or being defeated, but in any case being in the public eye.
My goal in life, she says, is to go down in history as the wife of a president.
Well, he must have been very happy to hear that. I think in a way she did go down in history that way.
Her name wasn't Pat.
No, her name wasn't. She took that name herself when she enrolled in college. Not entirely sure exactly why she took the name Patricia, really, and then Pat for a nickname. But no, that wasn't even her given name. And also, her father, who was not at home, was a home birth, and he was not at home when she was born, immediately gave her the nickname of, you know, his St. Patrick's babe in the morn. However, from everything I can find out, she was born the day before St. Patrick's Day. So people have always had their ideas and superimposed them on Mrs. Nixon.
In fact, all her life, she was subject to being renamed. I thought I'd ask you to read this list of nicknames.
Quite incredible, I think, yes. Her nicknames, Buddy, Miss Vagabond, Irish Gypsy, St. Patrick's Babe in the Morning, Babe, Pat, Miss Pat, Dearest Heart, The White Sister, Starlight. And that was her code name.
And one of the things that's so nice about this book is that these are the names as we come to encounter her. It's like a piece of music finally we learn who called her Starlight, the CIA. But she likes it. She likes being called Starlight because Aunt Beattie imagines why. She had that little rhyme. Starlight.
Starbright, first star I see tonight. I wish I may, I wish I might have the wish I wish tonight, which was by Anonymous. No one knows who wrote that poem. Yeah.
And so there's the sense of, okay, we have Starlight as the CIA name. I mean, they're given to all kinds of vagaries when they name the people they're protecting.
Yeah.
She likes her name. Well, says the writer, maybe she liked it because of that rhyme. Where could she sensibly recite that rhyme? Clearly, at nighttime, best on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And so we watch a writer imagine out of whole cloth, and we see how insane, how demented this process can be, because the writer is just improvising and saying, how am I doing? But there's no one there to ask. So you got to go on to the next page and the next page, inventing more things out of a stray comment from the daughter, Julie, or trying to imagine why Julie and not Trish was the spokesperson for the family, and recognizing that in certain ways, well, Mrs. Nixon sort of reminds me of my own mom in certain respects, and watching how you build a character. Now, the best thing I think you do, it just took my breath away, is when you made a distinction between something that would be useful in a story and something that would be just an anecdote. You're telling a story about Halloween.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's actually reported in a book by Monica Crowley, I believe. The Nixons, when they were living in New Jersey, had a tradition, and of course they were very reclusive at that time. But on Halloween, they always came to the door, and it was people, you know, from the neighborhood, people assembled to come to the Nixons and certainly wanted to be noticed by the Nixons. One person decided the best way to get noticed was to put on a Nixon mask. So Richard Nixon opened the door. I have no idea where his wife was when he opened the door, but one can imagine, somewhere around seeing this from the sidelines. And there was Richard Nixon seeing a guy standing there in a Nixon mask.
Saying trick or treat.
Yeah.
with his child.
Holding his boy's hand, yeah.
So before long, you point out this would be a good joke in a sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, how does a writer work with the material?
Yeah, that it is a book about writing, and so I'm questioning myself a lot of the time in that it's not really very fertile ground a lot of the time. You know, it does almost require you to do something hypothetically and see if that works. But at the same time that I do something hypothetically, I always try to rein things back in and really comment overtly on the fact that I'm using, say, a fictional technique or that I am just guessing, but here's why I'm guessing in this way. Here's maybe something else I read that informed me, because writers, of course, believe in the world through literature as well as just believing what their lying eyes tell them.
Well, in this case, okay, doorbell rings, trick or treat. Well, there, in this case, is someone in a Nixon mask, but also someone in a Bush mask and someone in an LBJ mask. And Nixon says, maybe. I've never seen more American presidents in one night.
I think actually he did say that. I think I'm stating a fact there, if I remember correctly. Well, he was not without a sense of humor, certainly. I don't think that's the primary thing that comes to mind when we think about Richard Nixon. But he was quick, you know? He was quick. Even on the tapes, he says things that are horrifying, but he's fast.
And so Anne Beattie, the writer, says, this is a pretty good joke, but if we saw it in a book, we'd say, oh, the writer's making it up.
Yeah.
It's too fast. So she says, well, what if Mrs. Nixon answers the door? Or better yet, what if Mrs. Nixon's grandchild answers the door?
Mm-hmm.
What if Mrs. Nixon's grandchild opens the door and thinks it's really Grandpa, and he's frightened.
That's exactly what happens in that scene, yes. The little boy rushes out into the crowd, rushing toward the non-Nixon Nixon, and there is another little kid there, too, and there's no record of these kids ever meeting or anything like that, but it does seem like a perfectly possible moment. And Mrs. Nixon then herself has a moment of doubt and thinks, it's incumbent upon me, I'm the grandmother, I should rush out and bring my grandson back, and yet she's just tired. She's just really tired of what her prescribed role has always been and is supposed to be, and she resists it. She hangs back.
And that sense of exhaustion, of being tired of being Mrs. Nixon, is where the novelist starts to creep in with something deeper than an anecdote or an amusing circumstance, just plausible because it is Halloween. And so we find out in Mrs. Nixon how a novelist begins to make something thicker, how to give it what Ann Beatty calls anthropological or archaeological layers, to give it a depth that you wouldn't expect. In her new book, Mrs. Nixon, A Novelist Imagines a Life. Now, for a while, a reader might think, oh, fish in a barrel, she's making fun of the Nixons. But that's not what this book is doing. What this book is doing is asking, how do I take these people who've been sad and ludicrous and a trademark of what went wrong with our country with Watergate and Vietnam, how do I restore their souls? In a way, it's a novelist, even perhaps a little against her will, acting with the generosity that literature allows.
Well, you're right. I certainly wouldn't have thought to have approached this subject in the 1970s. As with so many people in my generation, he was simply my nemesis and she simply didn't exist for all intents and purposes. But that, therefore, when you feel like you do know something in a general way and you go back and you examine the evidence and you find out, no, it was never exactly that. It was never that easy. That's what makes you want to open some cans of worms in a way.
And the book, as it moves along, changes. Is it a book of anecdotes about the Nixons, about Pat, about how to write? And strangely, Ann Beatty enters, a famously invisible writer. She doesn't appear in any of her stories or novels, but soon she's telling us that she went shoe shopping with her mother in a Washington department store, and?
And there was Mrs. Nixon with one of her daughters. There you have it.
In fact, Mrs. Nixon was trying on the same burnt orange spike-heeled shoes that Ann was trying on. Mrs. Nixon looks over and says to Ann's mom, "We wore these in the 40s, didn't we?" And Mom says, "We sure did." And then we turn the page, and Anne explains.
You really want me to tell?
I do.
Well, I explain that I never did meet Mrs. Nixon, therefore pulling the rug out from under myself. But starting the second chapter, the one that follows the one we were talking about, by saying, no, I never met her, but you wanted me to have met her, didn't you? You know, so I'm also dealing with readers' expectations and how much, even though something is fictional in general, you believe that there are facts within the fiction, but you fall into a trap for believing that particular one.
And you wanted there to be an explanation for this book, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly.
Because the book feels zany and mystifying. Why are we getting this book right now? And gradually, as we read, we discover things about fiction. That fiction, for instance, alters time. What do you mean by that?
Oh, I can't even paraphrase that one very easily. But, I actually invoke examples of other fiction. For example, it is true, it is reported to be true, that Mrs. Nixon gave Mr. Nixon a collection of stories by Guy de Maupassant. And I take a random story. I take an often anthologized story called The Necklace and give a reading of that in case the reader might not have that right in the reader's mind at that moment. And it's a very interesting story in that it, too, it's like a fairy tale. You know, we hear about 10 years. We hear about things that are nebulous but that are given to us very quickly. Nothing approximates the real time it would take to elapse. But what happens in the story is that a woman borrows a necklace from a wealthy woman. She's a very vain woman, the woman who does the borrowing. And she goes to a ball. It's very like Cinderella. She ends up losing the necklace. She and her husband work for 10 years, finally get the money back, buy a necklace identical to, as identical as they can find to that necklace. The necklace is returned, and the woman who has loaned the necklace simply says, oh, that was just paste. What a shame. What a shame.
It was only worth 500 francs.
Yeah. So, you know, there you have something that really is ostensibly the most dramatic thing that could be told about this particular couple and what they went through. But it all happens so very quickly. It's almost in your face. It's a moral lesson. And so it has to happen very quickly. But my reason for bringing that up at all is the inherent weirdness of, I mean, we do know enough about Mr. Nixon to know that even when he was younger and perhaps more open-minded about things, his character less formed, less nefarious, that getting a book of de Maupassant's short stories. I mean, what could he possibly have made of those, you know? So there are a lot of things butting up against each other, and that alone alters chronological time.
And so we're gradually understanding that what Anne Beattie is doing is asking us, how do we humanize these figures, and what is human? Sometimes what is human is even more disappointing than a story by Guy de Maupassant because, well, what did Nixon give her? He gave her, I think...
He gave her a clock, didn't he?
And a paperweight.
And a paperweight, yes, yes.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Anne Beattie, author most recently of Mrs. Nixon, A Novelist Imagines a Life. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Anne Beattie about Mrs. Nixon. It's published by Scribner's. These anecdotes show, in many ways, how the Anne Beattie that we've been reading for all these years develops a character to something far deeper than a cartoon or a commonplace or a representative member of a generation. And it works almost in a mysterious way. The point seems to be that until it's working, a novelist doesn't know that, what, you keep at it, yes?
Yes, and I think that the idea of a character building in a way that you don't feel that you have an easy handle on that character. In other words, incrementally, it's easy to move around and to talk about Mrs. Nixon, what she looks like standing behind microphones in China, what her thoughts might be. But it's the cumulative effect of butting these things up against each other in some sort of order that makes sense, not in chronological time per se, but almost like they're a kind of emotional assemblage, because sometimes we are laughing, sometimes we are sad. It seems like with Mrs. Nixon's life, you don't want to just stack the deck against her or anything like that. But really, some of the emotions, I think, could only be interpreted certain ways.
And then an accident happens or seems to happen that Aunt Beattie recognizes that this quality of staying at it, of sticking to it, is one that she shares with Mrs. Nixon. That you've, in writing, got to have faith and trust to what you've committed to. She's made a commitment, and now she's going to keep it. She's going to keep it even if it means staying silent. So this interesting space between Mrs. Nixon and Aunt Beattie begins to form and take a kind of density where we see, oh, this is what makes someone human. Staying at it without knowing why, but so does a novelist.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a cliche of being a good wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's really trapped by a lot of things, and she's very trapped, of course, because of the times. It would be very different if Mrs. Nixon was hypothetically it would. It could be very different if Mrs. Nixon was the wife of Richard Nixon today in 2011. But, these were times that had certain expectations. Language itself was used in particular ways. I actually bring some things in, such as Life magazines, for example, the kind of language that was used when talking about her daughter's wedding, her White House wedding, and so forth. And interesting to me, too, that what was written journalistically often had the same kind of vocabulary that now would sound to us very corny or very odd that Mrs. Nixon had. But we do forget that about people, that, we often look at them disembodied from the time in which they existed. And she had a very difficult time, because we have our own verbal cliches and so forth, but she really had them then, really a lot of limitations on what she could say and the way things were talked about. What we really don't know, because she never wrote about it. She is, of the modern first ladies, the only one I'm aware of who simply never kept notes at the White House. We don't have a diary. As far as I know, we don't have anything. She did not write a memoir when she got out of office. But what did she think incrementally about these things? But, I can't just question her. I have to question myself, too. What do I think of them?
And then Mrs. Nixon, just in one of the stray clues that you find, it's a photograph that Richard Nixon insisted on having taken of them leaving the White House.
Yeah.
Mr. Nixon, Mrs. Nixon, the daughters, their husbands, all in line. And Mrs. Nixon is not looking at the camera, and she is not smiling. And the Aunt Beattie points out, always on the alert for the animal set, that the dogs aren't there, but they're the only ones excused from this ceremonial thing. And Mrs. Nixon thinks, he's got us arranged like a chorus line. We're like paper dolls.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, this book by my guest, Aunt Beattie, this remarkable book, Mrs. Nixon, takes on this sudden, incremental mounting of all the things that you've brought to bear between Mrs. Nixon writing, making jokes about people, self-deprecation, enforced graciousness, and suddenly the last 20 pages are some of the most moving pages, without explicitly saying so. Like certain novelists who, realizing that they've stranded their character in a horrible world and that they shouldn't do this to a creature of their own imagination, it's as if Aunt Beattie reaches in and cradles Mrs. Nixon or embraces her, and Mrs. Nixon starts to speak in Aunt Beattie's voice and Anne in Mrs. Nixon's voice. And it's the most incredible crisscross in which imagination is put on display in its role as empathizer. There's even astonishment. Like, if we saw a photograph of Aunt Beattie, it would be, whose voice is coming out of my mouth? But this is the voice of a novelist, when suddenly the character is speaking.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's beyond great. Tonally, I was trying to set her free at the end, too. You know, that would be my impulse, too. Whether you want to be set free or not, you are when you put that last period and you end the book. So you might as well come to terms with it as the writer. But my sympathy was so great for her at the end of the book that I thought the fair thing to do would be to get a little personal. I mean, Ann Beattie talks about Ann Beattie in the next to last section. And then I thought, but, you know, she's out there beyond me, as she really is. She's in history, for better or for worse. And she's gone, too. She's escaped. But I really wanted her physically to escape, too. And she did spend a lot of time. She liked to walk. She often had to walk in disguise. I have her walking on the beach at the very end, and I read her thoughts, and I think it's very clear to the reader that there's a, yes, as you say, I mean, that I'm conflating my thoughts with her thoughts, but they only come through her language and who she is at that very last moment of the book. I also had to give some thought really to how much I could put myself overtly in there with a little almost personal essay in the next to last section, and the last section is very, very brief that follows it, you know, not just seeming to be gratuitously doing a little dance or something like that, but it was as though, well, if you've believed that it's all fiction up to this point, no, let's talk about me sitting on my porch in Maine having some thoughts I really have and looking at what the outside world is beyond the porch and so forth. And then when that section concludes, going to Mrs. Nixon on the beach and what her reality was. But I think, again, you can't help, since they're butted up against each other in the book, butting up those two realities against one another. And you see women of very different backgrounds, experience, generations, etc. I think having something in common, though their language never would have allowed them to talk. I don't think I would have understood what she said, and I don't think she would understand what I said.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I'm talking with Ann Beattie. She is the author, most recently, of Mrs. Nixon, A Novelist Imagines a Life. Thank you, Ann, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm. He is a bookworm. She's a bookworm. We are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.